You're listening to a recorded talk from Greenbelt Festival.
Now, you might think this is an odd title for a person who's not married and who doesn't have any children, a world fit for our children. And I suppose I could say, well, I've chosen this title because the children of the future might decide to reverse the cut on the winter heating allowance for people over a certain age. But really, I take this title because I believe that when Jesus said, anyone who does the will of God is my brother and sister and mother, then that means that anyone who is part of that family is related to everybody else. And it is not genetics which connect us to each other. It's the love of God. And therefore, those who have children and grandchildren deserve the support of those who don't. And future generations should be as important to me as if I had a family of my own. Now, what I'm going to do is what I'm not going to do is to give an idea of what the future should be like. That is something which people of my generation cannot control. And to some extent, it should be in the hands of those who come after us. But I hope, first of all, to do a kind of reflective thing about the past and the present, and then to do something about how those of us who are of the age we are might enable those who come after us to have a better future. So some of this is kind of anecdotal, and I'm going to move from the past to the present. And I began thinking about, and you may want to do this on your own, I began thinking about what is it, if I were to be a teenager today, what would I miss compared to my own childhood? If I were to be a teenager today, what would I miss compared with my own childhood? Now, these things are not conclusive, and you may have other things. But one of the things for me, and I'll maybe think of four or five, and I'll keep to time, would be the absence of affluence. Because when I grew up, Britain was not the kind of commercial enterprise that it is now. I didn't come from a wealthy family. When I was aged 18, and in sixth form, I had pocket money of £4 a week. If I went out for a drink with my friends on a Saturday, I could buy 4 pints of beer for 50 pence. And that was an eighth of my pocket money. As a student, because I came from a poor family, I had a full grant, which was about £100 per term. And I shared a flat. I was the son of a factory worker. And I shared a flat with the son of the most important bank manager in my hometown. And his mother was keen that he should share a flat with me because she thought if I was going to be a minister, I might be a good influence on her son. She was a misguided lady. And so we existed on the same amount because Dennis's father said, you'll get no more than John Bell. So he had £100 a term. And that was for our rent and for our books and for our food. And we had to learn how to make a pound of sausages last for 4 days. And I was issued one day required to go and see the bank manager of the Royal Bank of Scotland because on one particular day I had overdrawn by £1.50. And I went in to eat humble pie in the front of this important man. The grant was a great leveller. It meant that we who had a grant had no more money than apprentices of the same age as ourselves. And for a holiday, well, we would hitchhike to London or to Edinburgh and stay in tents during the Edinburgh Festival or the great attractions of the capital. And now I live in a student area and have done for quite a while, and money is really no object. And most of the students who live near me eat out rather than cook for themselves. And you can see the effect of this because there's a measured mile of a main road. It's called the Great Western Road. And there's 2 points about a mile apart. And when I lived there in 1969, there were 2 cafes, 2 fish and chip shops, 2 pubs, and 2 restaurants. And now, at least at the last count, there are 24 cafes, 14 takeaways, 7 pubs, and 6 restaurants. And that has all happened since students began to have loans rather than grants. And no one is being pulled in for being overdrawn by £1.50. It's more likely that the Royal Bank of Scotland manager will say, "How much do you want, son? I mean, 3,000 or 4,000 a term might not be enough. Maybe we could take it up to 15 a year, and then when you leave, you'll have 40,000 to pay back." Now, what happened between then and now is that a government under Tony Blair, with two former student leaders, Gordon Brown and Jack Straw, decided that they wanted to increase, potentially, the number of young people going to university, school leavers, up to 50%. So they had to beef up tertiary institutions, and that needed money. So abolish the grants for which you get no refund and establish loans. But also, we've gone through a period of hyperinflation from which we've never recovered. When I was 18, I could buy 4 pints with 1/8 of my pocket money. Now these 4 pints would cost £24. If I was 18 today, my pocket money, if it were at the same level as in 1968, would have to be £180 a week. The first mortgage I had at 28 was for £6,000. I got a 100% mortgage because the house I was buying was at that price, and my starting salary was £6,000. That job now, the starting salary is £34,000. But you will not find a three-roomed house in Glasgow for £34,000. The one that I bought in 1978 is now valued at £220,000. Money has gone crazy, and the young did not engineer this, but they have inherited it. The second thing which I would miss if I were 18 today would be the abundance of choice. Now, this might seem an odd thing to say, but to some extent it depends where you grew up. I grew up in a town called Kilmarnock. In 1968, it had 7 major industries, of which 6 exported all over the world. Now it has none. 1968, it had 6 cinemas. They ranged from the kind of, I suppose it was kind of avant-garde or Art Deco top-grade plaza to one which was colloquially known as the Wee Itchy. 6 cinemas, all within 500 yards of each other. Now there is only 1 cinema, and it's in the periphery of the town, and you need a car to go there, and it's about as alluring as a jerry-built crematorium. 7 cafes making their own ice cream, and now only 2. 7 men's clothing stores, 4 of which were national brands, and 3 which were local, and now only 2. And at that time, no advertising in buses, no adverts of sponsors and football shirts, no adverts on glossy paper shoved through your door. Whereas now there's a presumption of choice. You go into one of these shopping malls and there's a presumption of choice, but note how many sell virtually the same things and how many tend to close down from time to time. And now the young are confronted with style managers or influencers. These sad, jaded, famous for 5-minute would-be celebrities offering not independent analysis of best buys, but promoting the products of the companies who pay them. And people will say, well, Spotify's a great thing. You can hear anything you want. And look at all these television channels. Ah, choice normally is about looking at 2 or 3 different things intently and making a measured decision. But channel surfing is more an indication of some kind of neurotic activity rather than choosing. Now, what happened? Well, there was a decimation of British industry by buyouts from companies with no local provenance. Huge manufacturing company in Kilmarnock called Glenfield and Kennedy, a hydraulic engineering company. I've seen their products in Australia, bought over by Crane. the patents of what they produced were purchased, the manufacturing base was sent to Taiwan, and 900 people lost their job. Johnnie Walker's whiskey, exported all over the world, began in Kilmarnock, and then Diageo took it over and decided there was another place where they could bottle the whiskey, so they shut down the firm in Kilmarnock, making 900 families the victims of unemployment. And there was the takeover of small retailers by the high street giants. You know, if you try to find an ironmonger's in Glasgow, it's like looking for a needle in a haystack. You will not find it anywhere in the city centre. You'll have to go to a retail park and to go in to B&Q, whereas previously there would have been many. The high street giants take over either by a single businessman or companies. Harrods is not owned by Sir Hugh Fraser, the Scot, as once was, nor the would-be Englishman, Mohammed Al-Fayed. It's owned by the Sovereign Wealth Fund of Qatar. Philip Green owns BHS, or did, Topshop, Burton, Dorothy Perkins, Evans, and other brands. Mike Ashley, Sports Direct, plus Slazenger, Cangall, Umbro, and he has the hands and the pies of Matalan and JB Sports. A chain, in terms of a chain store, a chain is a curious term because a chain is not about freedom. A chain is about restrictiveness. And here there is a restrictiveness in those who control the purchases which are advertised. Remember how Borders Bookshop came into Britain. It came from Ann Arbor in America, and bought over small bookshops. It happened in Glasgow, five small bookshops all shut down, bookshops which had been there since the 18th century, and had this great bank building taken over with five floors, and we loved it. And then Borders Bookshop closed down because it collapsed under its own mega weight, and a city with four universities and several tertiary education colleges was bereft of good bookshops. Choice has collapsed, monopolization has come to stay, and Amazon deliveries have replaced customer service. And the young did not engineer this reality, but they are its subjects. And then there's sexual naivety. This seems like an odd thing to say. But those of us of my age and a bit younger, that's the culture we grew up in. I remember we had a talk from a biology teacher. I mean, it's really funny, for sexual relations, you went to biology teacher. And this man said, well, sex is like getting on a train from Kilmarnock to Glasgow. And there are intermediate stations. There's Kilmore, Stourton, Dunlop, and Barrhead. And the decision is, which station will you get off at? And I thought, well, if I'm going to Glasgow, I'm not going to get off at Dunlop. I mean, it's a very bad analogy, but that's the best that this man who was perspiring profusely could do. But then the common knowledge and expectation was that sex would happen in the context of a committed relationship rather than a leisure activity, and preferably it would happen in marriage. There were no condom machines in gents' toilets. In Kilmarnock, you would go to Glasgow to buy condoms on that train. And you would go there because if you bought condoms and boots, somebody would tell your mother. And if you tried to buy them in a hairdresser's, he would tell your father. So it was better to go out the road. And the nearest to dirty books was a lingerie page of the Daily Express. But we talked about sex. And there were lots of nice stories. I remember this story about this. The Church of England had made this report about sexual behaviour, and there was a curate in a particular diocese who was really very vexed by this. And he thought he should have a word with his bishop. So he went to the bishop and he said, "My Lord Bishop, I just think it's absolutely terrible. We're in this licentious and lascivious age in which people are having sex all over the place. The whole thing is so scandalous. I mean to say, I never had sex with my wife before marriage, did you? And the bishop said, I don't know, what was your wife's maiden name? But that has changed, and I'm making no judgment, I'm just stating the obvious. It's changed, and it's partly changed because we have these role models who appear to titillate rather than to educate. People who go on reality shows who are chosen not for their intelligence, but for their stud quality or their good looks or their ability to be daring. And that's what those who are younger look at. In the past, where I would, at the age of 18, walk a girl home and then walk for 2.5 miles through the snow or the rain back to my own home, now I have friends whose 15-year-old boys routinely expect that they'll be able to sleep in the parental home with their current girlfriend. The young did not initiate this culture, but they have inherited it. And what's happened? Well, much has to be put down to some extent to the internet, because that has changed things entirely with regard to the way in which people perceive of sex. I'm reading from a report in The Guardian 2 days ago, and it's about how AI-generated images and the seduction of people who get in touch with teenagers encourage them to show photographs of themselves, and then they end up being blackmailed by people in Britain or in Africa. And this I found particularly sad about a 14-year-old boy who sent some pictures of his face to a girl he had met online and discovered that his face was being used to make a deep fake pornographic video. And children of that age are now beginning to consider suicide if the images which they thought would be only shared among friends online are actually shared by predators. Plus the fact that, in a way which none of us here will know, the availability of pornography to children who have access to a smartphone is unbelievable. I once was asked to go to a project called Stop It Now. It's based in Edinburgh. There are places where this is based elsewhere, set up by the police and by social work agencies in order to try to deal with people who've been caught potentially going to be prosecuted for looking at online pornography dealing with children. And when I was there, they introduced me to two people, and one of them was a young man who had been charged by the police, and his name was in the local papers. He seemed to be rather like a naive 24-year-old who really shouldn't get into this mess because he was otherwise a very respectable young guy. And I said to him, so what's it like, you know? I've no idea what child pornography is like. Is it like a compulsion? Is it like an addiction? He said, no, it's like a vortex. You are just pulled into this deeper and deeper, and you are seduced into wanting, compelled to see more and more horrific images. And I mentioned smartphones, and I suppose that's one of the other things which I would not miss, but I'd find very difficult in the present day. It's hard for anyone to imagine, anyone under 30, to imagine a world without mobile phones or smartphones. A world in which if you said to somebody, I'll get you at 7 o'clock outside the Plaza Cinema, you would be there at 7. You wouldn't phone up and say, oh, I'm still in the bath, I'm sorry, I'm running against time, or I'm losing time. A world in which if someone said, you see that Dalai Lama, I wonder what age he is, he's marvellous. To say that in all innocence, whereas now you say that and somebody becomes very energetic and suddenly says, oh, he's 89, he was born on the 6th of July 1935, as if the earth would stop revolving unless this innocuous fact was discovered, courtesy of the smartphone. Go any hour of the day into Glasgow Underground or walk through the streets of the city and count the number of people who are not holding on to their mobile phone, never mind using it, just holding it as if this were a genetically modified attachment to their body. We didn't get a phone. I didn't get a landline until I was 17, and only because my father was in the Telephone Samaritans and sometimes would be on overnight duty. But we got this phone, and about 3 months later, I went to a barn dance in a village outside Kilmarnock, and it's spelled M-O-S-C-O-W. M-O-S-C-O-W, and in Ayrshire, where I come from, it's called Moscow. So I'm at this dance, and I realise I'm going to be late. I should be back by 11:30. I'm going to be later. And I remembered 26561, that's our new phone number. So I found a phone box, and I reversed the charges. Now, the person who was arranging, if you remember in these days, you spoke to an operator, was, I'm not being racist, he was an English person. And I could hear him phoning 26561. My father said, yes, David Bell speaking. And this guy said, there's a reverse charges called from Moscow. And my father says, who the hell is phoning me from Moscow? And then the guy said, oh, I'll let you hear just one word. So I said, Dad, and then my father said, it's from Moscow, you idiot, and it's my son. Last week, Dame Wendy Hall, Professor of Computer Science at the University of Southampton, indicated that there were AI scams involving the voice of a young person being mimicked and sent to the smartphones of her parents and friends asking for money. Now, I have a smartphone now. It was a prerequisite of a rail ticket going round Europe, which I had for 4 weeks in March. At its best, I see it as a great means of finding information quickly, but at its worst, I regard it as the equivalent of the snake in the Garden of Eden, offering access to all knowledge and all mystery, reduced to bullet points and statements devoid of any context. A smartphone now linked to AI has the potential to be highly pernicious, especially when we swallow the information it bestows as if it were undoubtedly the truth. The question Pilate puts to Jesus, what is truth, is very pertinent now, especially when the communicators of truth, like Elon Musk, are weird people. He and people like Jeff Bezos, never mind Donald Trump, they are weird people whose unaccountable wealth gives them the presumption that they should address the world as if they were elected leaders. They're also the monitors for what passes as truth. I spoke recently to an academic teaching a master's course in an English university. And he teaches in the master's course both British and foreign students. He notes that very often people will not speak in a tutorial, but when they submit papers for examinations, the papers are word perfect. There are no spelling errors, but nor are there any colloquialisms or references to the people's own lives. And he suspects, as other academics do who I've spoken to recently, that some of these submissions to be graded for a degree have been produced by AI or have come from elsewhere. And you wonder what kind of world it is we live in when people would rather have their worth attested by employing an artificial brain rather than by using their own intelligence. But it is not the young who set up these systems, but they are the inheritors. And maybe one other thing before I look at the future, and it's to do with the abundance in the 60s and 70s of optimism and hope. They were there. I think last year I mentioned Joan Bakewell, who is a kind of czar for the elderly. And speaking of how in the 50s for her, as in the 60s and 70s for me, the world had few threats. We even were naive enough, no, it wasn't naivety. We believed that the arms race, at least the nuclear arms race, could be stopped if enough members of the cabinet would vote in a particular direction. One day the Vietnam War would be over, and it was over. One day the arms race perhaps would be no more. One day apartheid would be abolished, and it was abolished. These things were possible. But with climate change and with a kind of international moments of tension which seem to go on forever, it's as if those who are young are faced consistently, if they go to the news, with negativity rather than with possibility. So what of the future? Well, I've hitherto spoken not very much from a Christian perspective, but I'm going to do so now and be a bit more bold about it. For we're encouraged by Jesus not to be like Lot's wife. Lot's wife looked back on that which was past and was in the process of being destroyed, and she could advance no further. She became immobilized. So I'm going to allude to four biblical references, which I believe are important for those of us who are not teenagers or young 20s today, but might enable us to enable those of that age group to move positively into the future. And the first is to tell the hidden history. And here, I want to allude to an instance in the life of Jesus which happens right at the beginning, when he goes to his home synagogue. It's in Luke chapter 4. And it's that story in which he stands up. It's in three stages. He stands up and he reads from the prophecy of Isaiah. And the people are quite amazed at his eloquence, his lovely voice. His mother must be very proud of him. There she's sitting there. It's a story for which I have a great fondness, because I once was asked to preach, not in my home synagogue, but in the oldest church in the town from which I come. The steeple was built in 1410, and some members of the congregation were there at the laying of the foundation stone. And I wouldn't know the people there because they've changed. I left the town when I was 18, and it's become a kind of commuter belt. But I thought, well, some people possibly were at school with me. At the end of the service, which is a very happy occasion, it was some anniversary, I stand at the door greeting people, and there's the usual pleasantries, thanks for coming, nice to see you. And then this woman comes up, who was my mother's age at that time, 76, and she shakes my hand, and with her left index finger, she pokes my chest and says, "I used to bath you." And then she goes away without me having a chance to say, "It's time you did it again, sister." She's gone. Well, Jesus had the approbation for his voice, and even when he said what Isaiah said about good news for the poor, it's becoming real in my person today. And they take that. But then he says, quotes two instances from Jewish history, which are in the Bible, of how two prophets, one was called Elijah and one was called Elisha. And during a time when there was famine in Israel, Elijah, the Jewish prophet, helps a Syrian widow to survive. Not a Jewish widow, a Syrian widow to survive. And then Elisha, his protege, at a time when there were plenty of Jewish lepers, he enables the healing, not of a Jewish leper, but the healing of an enemy captain whose name was Naaman. And in hearing this, the congregation rise up and take Jesus to the brow of the hill on which Nazareth, his hometown, was built, with the express intent of throwing him over the side, the first direct attempt on his life. Now, why did he do this? Because he had reminded them of the history they wanted to forget, which was that God loved more than Jews, and that other people in the world were equally deserving of a God who made all humanity in his image. Now, I kind of think that the riots which were caused, which happened in our shores in the last two or three weeks ago, have a number of factors which we can all rehearse. The anger of dispossessed British people who think that people seeking asylum are getting a better deal than they are. The sense that after the misery of the pandemic, things have not got better and people are ready to vent their frustration. Long-term moral and social degeneration caused by years in which youth provision in terms of clubs, recreational facilities, and access to mental health care have all been cut back. If you have the money, buy a book by Polly Toynbee. I know she has heavily opinionated things to say in The Guardian, but this book called Things Can Only Get Better is a record of degeneration during the 14 years of the Conservative government. And it will be the yardstick by which the new Labour administration will be judged. Things Can Only Get Better by Polly Toynbee. But one might also notice that many of the rioters were male, the vast majority. And I don't think that these people who rioted would have been Labour voters. I suspect that quite a lot of them might have been from Reform. And if they know anything about the British voting system, would know that despite the millions who voted Reform, they have a disproportionately few number of representatives in Parliament. So maybe that was behind some of it. But as well as that, I want to suggest that what might bind some of these criminals with the people who tried to take Jesus' life is a lack of knowledge about the history of their own nation. I'm not convinced that we in Britain know our history. I'm convinced that I certainly don't know the history of my country. 1707, allegedly, Scotland and England got together and became the United Kingdom. Only recently, not in school history, did I discover the reason for this. And it wasn't because we had waved to each other across the border and liked each other so much that we may as well join hands, and having had a common crown, we could have a common government. Not at all. It was because Scotland was daft enough to become bankrupt by trying to establish a colony and a part of Panama which was totally uninhabitable. The nation bankrupted itself on what's called the Darien Project, and England had to come and bail us out. I never learned this. I never learned that Ireland was Britain's first colony, in which we practiced all we did in other parts of the world. We forbade people to have their own language. We changed the names of towns. And west of Scotland, Protestants were recruited to tame the Catholics who were living in the north. I know that I learned history at school about the Napoleonic Wars and Italian unification, but nothing about Scotland and the slave trade. A quarter of the slave plantations in Jamaica were owned by Scots, and never dawned on me that we have a Jamaica Bridge. I mean, is that there because it was a favoured holiday destination for people in the past? The University of Glasgow, to which I went, was partly built by the proceeds of the slave trade. But that knowledge was never told. It would come to some of us through reading. And some things come through experience. It was only 2 months ago, I was clearing out some books, and I come across this Bible, King James Bible, and I thought, that's not mine. And then I thought, well, maybe, you know, sometimes people give ministers and priests Bibles because they don't want to get rid of it themselves, and they think that we've got some kind of magic process whereby we can send it up to heaven. Well, I have to throw out these things. So I had no compunction. I'll throw out this Bible. I happened to open the front leaf, and inside, in very clear handwriting, it said, Private John Bell, the Highland Light Infantry. And then on the other side, in very shaky handwriting, Killed in Palestine, 1917. That belonged to my great uncle, my grandfather's brother. They went down the mine together when they were 13. My grandfather stayed as a miner during the First World War. Some of his brothers went to the front, and John Bell was killed in Palestine. And I began to think, what the hell was he doing in Palestine in 1917? So I bought a book about the history of Palestine and discovered that we have been there up to our necks since the Crusades. That we are the nation which handed over Palestine to the precursor of the United Nations, promising a homeland for the Jews, but never in print, although in words, never in print saying it would also be a homeland for the indigenous people who had lived there for centuries. We have a history of colonialism and of engagement in foreign nations, and it will come back to bite us, and much of that is happening at the present time. And if Britain, as regards the Middle East, or the Windrush generation, or Afghanistan, seems to have more than a difficult time with its former colonies and dependencies than, say, Spain, it might be because Peru had its independence from Spain in 1824. But our first colony in Africa to be given its liberation was Ghana, and that was in 1954. That was the first colony given its independence. And Barbados did not become fully independent until 2001. The ignorance of our past is something we share with other white Anglo nations like Australia, the USA. Not so with Germany, where all school children have to study the rise and consequences of fascism within their country. As with the congregation in Nazareth, learning about our history might be upsetting, but it also might provide a context in which we begin to understand the way the rest of the world looks at us, what it expects of us, and what perhaps we have to do as a former international colonizing power. The phrase of Jesus, "You shall know the truth, and the truth shall set you free," has universal application. Now, three other things, much more quickly. The one is that we should consider practicing restraint in all things, apart from generosity. It's no use people of my generation and the two after bemoaning the future we're bestowing as a toxic legacy on those who come after us, if we are unwilling to repent and change the ways, the lifestyle, and the standards to which we are accustomed now. If we are, who are older, feel that when the heat becomes 28 or 30 degrees, we should begin to consider air conditioning. Is this going to make life better or worse for our grandchildren? If we who are older and have two cars are resistant to stop driving or refuse to sell a car on the basis that we've always had two cars or one car, is that going to make future generations proud of us? If we who are older and financially comfortable kick up a fuss when the government withdraws the heating allowance, are we going to give future generations a good example of altruism to emulate? If we who are older bemoan our glorious past, which no young person can inhabit, but equally bemoan the dark days of the future, which we foresee our descendants will have to deal with, does that increase their hope and optimism? I have no right to suggest to younger generations how they should cope with the uncertainties of the future, but this side of eternity, I have the chance to amend my life in the face of what might help or hinder the future. And there are some things we can do, and some of them have to do with money. You may have seen in the papers last week a press report of a woman standing next to a huge inflated blue elephant in the Dam Square in Amsterdam. She had just inherited £21 million from her grandmother, but decided that she should not either receive or distribute that money which she had not earned. And so she bequeathed it to the Austrian government, she was an Austrian citizen, for them to distribute to worthy charities. I would love if that practice were emulated by the 15 billionaires who are under the age of 30, because they have never worked for, nor will ever work for, that money. They inherited it from the moment of conception. Excessive and unnecessary inherited wealth is an offence against heaven. Given the need of the poor and underprivileged in this nation and across the globe, will those of us who can take seriously the biblical injunction to dispose of 10% of our income by giving it to agencies, religious or secular, who are enabling God's purpose to be fulfilled. Just the other morning, I read this quotation from the founder of the Iona Community. We are not saved by works, but unless we are part of the saving work, salvation will not work for us. And some people just need a good example. I read in the Journal of the Irish Columban Fathers how Columbia, a small and oppressed nation, had announced at a cost to itself that it was suspending coal exports to Israel and they would only resume when the genocide stopped. Wouldn't it be great if this small nation did the same with the arms which we export to Israel? And take our model from the small, insignificant Columbia rather than the oversized America. And it can happen at an individual level. I met a couple recently in England who retired and who, at considerable cost to themselves, have made their house largely energy self-sufficient through solar panels and the installation of a heat pump. Now, can they afford it? Yes, they can afford it. Is it good for the planet? Yes. But they have also done it because they want people in the neighbourhood in which they live to see that this is a possibility. And they have gone through hell and high water to get the job done because they're one of the first in their area. But others now will have a model of what can be done. I'm not a parent or a grandparent, and I certainly don't set myself up as a model of altruism. But I do have a sign as you leave my front door, which I see every morning I go out, and it says, every day, give something away. And for the past 2 years, I've done that. Get rid of hundreds of books and CDs and clothes and furniture, which are surplus to my use, but may be of value to others, and create money for charities. On Tuesday, I got a note from Oxfam saying that since April, the things I do not miss, have earned them over £220. And I suspect that in this audience, 95% of the people over here have been talking about, at least those over 40, talking about how they have to slim down or get rid of stuff. That can be disposed of without anything but surrendering sentiment. The other thing is that we need to talk more. You may have followed radio programs which were charting up what happened when at first some school kids and then adults gave up their mobiles for a week. They talked more. We were made for conversation. God first said to Adam, "Where are you?" He expected a response. The Psalms encourage conversation. How long, O Lord, will you forsake me? It's a message sent to heaven. Jesus endorses it. He says to his disciples, what are we going to give these people to eat? Talking is not modeled on contentious adversarial debates at Prime Minister's questions or question time on the television or the radio. Conversation is a means of relating, of connecting, of recognizing the strength and vulnerability and ourselves and others, and expanding our horizons. I got on a train 2 weeks ago from London to Glasgow. A guy sat next to me, he was 26 years of age. As he sat down, I said, I hope this train is going to go in time. And he said, I hope this too. And we talked until he got off at Penrith for 3.5 hours. I loved every moment of speaking to someone whose age was a third of mine almost, and of discovering what life is like to him. He told me 3 things. The one was that he would never be a father. That was the decision he'd made. The second was that he'd never be able to repay the money which he got on loans for his education. And the third, that he would never have as high standard a life as his mother and father had. But he was filled with altruism and a concern for the future of the world, that he's been working only for charities to make life better in two very dangerous parts of the planet. I remember in Iona, years ago, we had young people from Glasgow, and they were in one of our centres with old people from the Midlands in England. And at the end of the first day, there were two questions. One is, are we always going to have home-cooked food? Because these kids, most of them from Glasgow, were sent out to buy takeaways, or it was like a television dinner. And the other is, are we always going to sit at tables? Because, as the teacher said, most of these kids don't have tables in their home. So they watch the television, or they sit in front of a computer. And when it came the Friday, when people were leaving, these children from Glasgow and these people with a funny accent from the Midlands were weeping, losing surrogate grandchildren and surrogate grandparents with whom they had talked, in a way they'd never talked to their parents. Now, here's my last thing. Read the story of David and Goliath. It might seem an odd thing to say. We know that story from childhood. But what we know is perhaps, or what we remember, not the most important part. Because we know that Saul heard that this boy, who was only about 12 years of age, was offering to go and fight the giant whom none of his soldiers could take on. And we know that Saul sent him out and that David killed him with his sword. What we don't really remember very often is that David killed him, with a sling, with a stone, and then he went over and he cut off the giant's head with the giant's own sword, and he carried the head back to Jerusalem. These gory details, we don't often rehearse. What for me is the most important part of that story is when Saul brings David into his tent, and having agreed that he will be able to go out and fight the giant. This is what he does. Saul put his own tunic on David, and then he placed a bronze helmet on his head, and he gave him a coat of mail to wear, and he then fastened his own sword on David over the tunic. And David said, "I cannot go with these because I am not used to them." So he took them off. Here is Saul, the adult whose forces have all worn tunics and helmets and breastplates and swords, and these means have been unable to secure the victory. And along comes a boy who will inherit the future of his nation and who refuses to use the very things which are failing adults, and instead uses a tactic which seems naive, but which in the end of the day is highly effective. Our adult lifestyles, our adult decisions, our adult strategies are gloriously failing in many directions: to make peace, to clothe the naked, to feed the hungry, to free the captive, to secure the health of the planet. We should not expect our children or grandchildren to win with the strategies which are failing us. We should pray for them, and we should encourage them that they might have the courage, the intelligence, and the ingenuity to find what in their day will secure their future. And pray God, may they find the ability, where it is needed, to forgive those in my and other older generations who have not given for them the heritage which they deserve. Thank you.
Thanks so much for listening to this recorded talk. Explore our full Greenbelt Festival Talks archive with almost 20 years of recorded talks and podcasts for free at greenbelt.org.uk/talks.